Some years ago, I came across a writing by the Reverend Howard Thurman, and he was a co-founder of the Church for the Fellowship of All Peoples in San Francisco. And this writing has continued to inspire my own heart and incline it towards just seeing things as they really are, which is about the practice of equanimity. So this is from a collection of his meditations entitled Deep is the Hunger. Deep is the Hunger. How may we work in the world courageously and intelligently on behalf of a decent world without despair and complete fatigue? What are the resources for personal rehabilitation and renewal, that we may be able to look out on life with its vicissitudes of cruelty and transient joys with quiet eyes and a tranquil spirit? I think this was written in the 50s, I think, and it's quite apropos especially for today's world. So seeing the world with quiet eyes is the name of this talk, and it's the subjective experience of equanimity, how we feel inside when we're looking outside, seeing the world with quiet eyes. So there are many qualities that embody this subjective experience of equanimity. People, we can feel calm, feel an inner quiet. There's a spacious, unbiased balance to see all sides. I love it when, you know, we can be with people and they can help us to see all sides. But of course, we want them to see our side best. You know? That's not quite equanimity, but we have a wide view when we can see all sides. It's spacious. It's not just in this small, narrow compartment of the mind of bias or the mind of preference. When reactivity is absent, and we clearly know that there's no reactivity there, meaning no attachment, no aversion, that's the opposite of equanimity, which is reactivity. It comes in two parts: attachment and aversion. When this is happening, when reactivity is absent from the mind and heart, there's an ability to have a wise view of the situation. So it can seem really calm, and maybe we're not going to do anything, but we have time to assess things so we can see how things are out there, assess what's going on in here, and then take an action that can be really powerful. So equanimity is an important subject to reflect upon because of the times we live in. And it's really hard for our hearts to navigate through this time. There's a lot of confusion on many scenes, on the environmental scene, on the political scene, just worldwide levels of strife, injustice. Talked about it before: racism, genderism, ageism, much more. So we feel pretty helpless around these times. I think helplessness is one of the basic feelings, descriptions of inner feelings that I get from a lot of people. So we're living in this age of proliferation and speed. There's a lot of news, and it comes so fast, and it bombards us almost. It feels like, I don't know about you, but it feels like I'm pummeled by the news sometimes. I have to really do a news fast, you know, just give it up for a while, not look, and not try to hear sounds that make me reactive. Certain people, certain faces, just really stay away from that. I mean, every day it's almost the same, right? So what's the use of reading it sometimes? And So it's perplexing to witness, even in ourselves, how much avoidance and delusion there can be. We don't want to stick our heads in the sands, but we don't want to get so reactive too, because normally we can with things that are pummeling us from the outside. The inside pushes back somehow or tries to protect itself. And this can be a reactivity that's not really helpful for us, an inner reactivity. So how to work with all this? So I'm just going to talk a lot about the various aspects of equanimity and its opposite, and we can see where we stand with that, and maybe some examples of how we can be more aware of that in ourselves so we're not taking hold of it and acting that out. So it's so perplexing, even in ourselves, to see how much there comes of this reactivity in relationship to the world. Just our very close world, you know, those people around us, our loved ones, that's where we need the most help sometimes. So this accessibility and speed of information about the news of the world continuously triggers us. Sometimes I'll use the practice of equanimity, just watching the heart and mind for places that it gets triggered and where it kind of reacts, just when I'm reading the news, to practice how it might be in the world, you know, when I'm facing somebody who's upset with me, like, you know, my own grown children. It's not too bad, but it's, you know, I'm a mother and it happens. And we have these ways of responding to pain, responding to how we would like our children to be more safe. And it goes on. You know, we're just human. So strong emotions habitually arise. And the emotions are different than that. Somebody asks, what's the difference between, you know, those subtle feelings of pleasant, unpleasant? There's a huge difference. Emotions of liking and disliking, and they're tighter, they're more solid, but the vedana of pleasant, unpleasant can be very ephemeral, you know, very thin, very refined. So just to answer a question I got about that. So strong emotions come up, and they're the emotions of reactivity, having to do with wanting the way we want it to be, or not wanting the way it is. So how do we get to know this more efficiently, more clearly? And that's through our practice of awareness, what we're learning, how we're learning to turn our attention to ourselves here over and over again, not be distracted as much by things out there, except things, of course, that nurture us like nature. And so there's a lot of unrecognized reactivity when we're not aware, when we don't have this training of mindful attention to look at what's going on inside. This reactivity is the opposite, of course, of equanimity. And when we're kind of lost in reactivity, we add more hurt to the world, more hurt and harm to the world. And sometimes we need to remind ourselves that it's harming our own karmic stream. Because every time we react with those attitudes and we just let them come out in a way that is a deep habitual pattern that doesn't even care about what it's going to do, what happens is that reactivity or that what happened, it came up in our minds. It goes out through our mouth or through our actions in the world or through kind of like the emotion that sometimes we use for controlling. And it goes back into our karmic stream because acting it out makes it stronger, makes the karma of those unbeneficial mind states to become stronger. And it has a strength to reseed in our karmic stream, and then it comes up again. So it's no wonder that we're faced with it over and over again because we let it out through our reactivity, through our mouth, through our speech, through our behavior. And now what we're learning how to do with our practice is learning to watch it or be aware of it before it even spreads or opens up in our minds. So how many of you, a lot of you are practiced here, practiced for a long time. You can see when, have this awareness when anger is coming, and you kind of nip it in the bud. It doesn't get filled out, right? Mm-hmm. How many of you have experienced that? Quite a few of you. It's possible to have that happen. Just by bringing mindfulness to that place is actually quite a bit of equanimity in play there already. It's said that all the beautiful qualities of mind, the wholesome qualities of mind, have a potential for accompanying mindful awareness. And so if we do bring equanimity on purpose, sometimes that will come kind of more in the foreground than awareness. So sometimes we can feel the equanimity stronger than we feel the awareness. But they can work together in a very powerful way. So here we have this opportunity to slow down and to do less and to feel the earth beneath our feet, to feel the heavens of the sky above, and see the stars at night, just really have a sense of that wider, wider view. Today I was walking up, and I forget which time it was, but there were several of you doing walking meditation out there, and I had this spontaneous thought. It's like we're in this monastery now, you know, we make this, and I just had a spontaneous thought, we must have all been in a monastery together. It's just like all this, you know, contemplative walking. And I noticed some of you would just stop and look up at a tree. And, you know, it's delight coming into the mind when you know that's happening and you're not just doing it deludedly, knowing there's delight there in the mind. That's beautiful. You know, there's a tender step. The next step can be very tender. It feels like you're hardly touching the ground somehow. And that's how it can be. That tenderness when we just feel the earth beneath our feet and the protection of the stars and the moon out at night. And we give ourselves this gift of sitting and walking quietly, being able to hear the sounds of nature around us, sensing all around this great gift that we've been given to be here together. So in this kind of quiet inner space and this quiet outer space, we're able to see life more clearly. And when we're really quiet, check in inside when there's any reactivity, when there's an absence of wanting something, because we can be perfectly content with just being slow, touching our feet to the ground, noticing what's to be seen around us, what's to be heard naturally around us. There's a sense of an absence of reactivity. Don't forget to note that as equanimity. That's natural equanimity flowing in our minds and our hearts. It's really helpful to note or to notice, if we don't use a word, to notice that, because it said that when we notice the beautiful qualities of mind, it nurtures them. We need beneficial qualities to open to life. But when we see the unbeneficial ones, it weakens them. So I don't know exactly how that works, but I see that's true. It's like one of those experiential understandings that we have with this practice. It's not like a particular law that's written down, but it's something that you see in your own practice. I love being able to quote Thomas Merton, because we're in this Catholic tradition, you know, walls and space and being served by, you know, there are quite a few places in the world that I offer the Dharma in a Catholic space. And I just feel so grateful for that tradition that I was raised in. I remember, this is a story, it's not in my notes, but before I quote Thomas Merton, I'm remembering a time that I had no equanimity. It was my very first retreat in Australia. And the retreat was being offered in a nunnery for retired Catholic nuns. And I was given this, I stayed in a dormitory where there were about 18 beds, maybe more, you know, beds lined up alongside this long, narrow room. And it was very hard. It was the hardest, one of the hardest retreats I ever did. And I was around a lot of Aussie women who were really like Amazon women. Anybody here from Australia? I mean that as a compliment. It's like they were sleeping with hardly any blankets, you know, all the windows were open, it was really cold. I took the extra woolen blankets, they were piled on me, and I couldn't sleep in that dormitory. And so I started going down to the hall, and at night I would sit next to a heater. And it made me stay up at night. You know, it made me sit up. I was really, my hair was on fire with the Dharma, so it made me stay up a lot at night and practice there. But I would remember that, oh, I feel like I just can't do this. I just can't do this. And I'd go up to my dormitory, and that's where the bathroom was, and I'd go in to do my thing in the bathroom, freshen up or whatever. And I'd go past the room where the nuns were saying the rosary. Mm-hmm. And I would go past that room to get into the dormitory, into the bathroom. And there were so many times when I thought, forget it, I'm going to go back to saying the rosary. And I wanted to open that door so many times to just go in and join them. Because it was so much easier to say the rosary than to watch my mind. So, anyway, I did remember a time of complete reactivity during that time. But I got over it. The practice took over. And here's what Thomas Merton says. You know, he's this Trappist monk that lived in the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky. He was a social activist, and he writes a lot about social activism. He actually was very interested in the Buddha Dharma, so he went to Sri Lanka to participate in some cross-cultural religious study. And that one of his trips, or maybe that was his only trip, he actually died there in Sri Lanka, Buddhist country. So I want to read a couple of quotes from him, and you may not agree with some of what he says because he can be very, you know, out there. But I can see, you know, how it can get when we get so reactive with what's happening in the world. This is from his writing called Courageous Rest, about doing this kind of a retreat. Some of us need to discover we will not begin to live more fully until we have the courage to do and see and taste and experience less than usual. There are times when, in order to keep ourselves in existence at all, we simply have to sit back for a while and do nothing. And for a person who has let themselves be drawn completely out of themselves by all their activity, nothing is more difficult than to sit still and rest, doing nothing at all. The very act of resting is the hardest and most courageous act a person can perform. So I think that's true sometimes, but not all the time, because we can get totally caught up in action. As someone said today, we should call ourselves human doings instead of human beings. And we're learning how to be human beings. This is his second one, The Busyness and Violence of Modern Life. He wrote this for activists. The rush and pressure of modern life are a form, perhaps the most common, of its innate violence. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit to too many projects, to want to help everyone and everything is to succumb to a kind of violence. The frenzy of the activist destroys their own inner capacity for peace, the fruitfulness of one's own work, because it kills the root of inner wisdom which makes work fruitful. So that last line, the frenzy of the activist destroys her own inner capacity. I was at a speech one time that His Holiness the Dalai Lama gave in San Francisco during the time he won the Nobel Peace Prize, I think it was 1989. And he was telling the story of when he was in Los Angeles just before that, and he was talking to a group of people about compassion, really, and then about what was happening in his country of Tibet. And someone came up to him and said, "I'm willing to help you. I'm willing to do everything I can," with a kind of frenzied anger about what was happening in Tibet. And he says, "I really want to help. Anything I can do. I have the means. Anything I can do." And His Holiness said, "Not now. Wait till you develop more equanimity, and then you can come and help." Because with that kind of frenziness, we're really of no help, right? So with the rush and pressure of modern life, it's quite understandable that we can feel vulnerable. This vulnerability, there's kind of a basic vulnerability that we all feel being born, and being born into this world of change. We don't want to really see it sometimes so closely. That's why it's hard to go deeply, because we see change on a really deep level. We're always wanting to solidify things, to make things permanent. But just like Vance was saying the other night, it's good to see the cup is already broken, to see that impermanent nature of that. So it's understandable that we feel agitated, depressed, anxious in our lives, especially this day and age. And the Buddha often talked about these eight worldly concerns. Someone mentioned early on in practice, one of you yogis mentioned the four pairs of vicissitudes that comprise the flux of life: praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. All these ups and downs we feel. It's a major reason for this existential vulnerability we have in our lives. Because something beautiful happens, and of course we want to hang on to it. Something doesn't happen that appeases us or is comfortable for us, and we want it to go away. You know, that's just kind of the nature of this level of existence. I'm just thinking of one of my friends who's also a yogi, and she came to me one time. She was a yogi that time, and she came to me with her report, and she said, "Kamala, I had this most beautiful sitting this morning. It was the best I ever had." And she was reporting to me in the afternoon. She said, "Wow, it was so wonderful. And you know what? There's nothing like a good sitting in the morning to ruin the rest of your day." And it's like you just hang on to that, right? Where is it? How did I sit? Maybe I was sitting with my knee up, and maybe actually my head was to that side, so I was sitting like that again. We just want to make it happen the same way all the time, instead of realizing things change, you know? So when are we ever going to really get it? That's what this practice is leading to. So external conditions are always triggering inner conditions of emotions, thoughts, mental states, happening all the time. Outer conditions force or trigger inner conditions to come about, and then we've got not only the first arrow of pain, when outer conditions are painful to us, but we have the second arrow when our inner reactivity happens and hurts us once again, and maybe hurts others too. So how many of you have heard of the two arrows? Yeah? First and second arrow, right. So we can't do anything about the first arrow a lot of times. We can do it, we have influence over what happens outwardly. We do have influence, but we don't have complete control. But we do have a responsibility to know what goes on inside of us so we can choose how we're acting and how we're, what we're saying in the world. And maybe even to ameliorate very heavy-duty thoughts of greed and hatred that come up in our minds. So I was reading once something about His Holiness the Dalai Lama when he was teaching. And I often have, not so much now, but I often would have these cringing moments after a Dharma talk, you know, or in the middle of a talk, I would say something. And I, even when my words are going out inwardly, I'm saying, why did I say that? You know, how are people going to think of me if I, you know, if they take that in? And so, and then I later on, you know, I'm in my room or something, and it's like I'm ready to go to bed, and I'm saying, "Ooh, it was that second arrow bothering me all the time." It was, "Ooh, I said that. I shouldn't." When people actually might say later, "You know, when you said that, that was very helpful," and I was thinking, "What am I thinking?" You know, always thinking badly of myself. So I read this from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I said, "Okay, I'm not alone." And this is when he was giving a talk on the eight vicissitudes. He said, the eight worldly concerns, wanting to be praised and not wanting to be criticized, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, wanting gain and not wanting loss, wanting fame and approval and not wanting rejection and disgrace. We all experience these, don't we? Even animals probably have them in some slight measure. I think all of us are concerned in particular about maintaining a good reputation. For example, when I'm up here on this throne teaching, this is the Dalai Lama now, not me, when I'm up here on this throne teaching, from time to time, somewhere in the back of my mind, there appears the thought, how am I doing? And even the Dalai Lama says that, so. How are people going to react to this? Are they going to praise me? Will people criticize me? Whenever this happens, I need to catch myself and say, look, now that I'm here transmitting the Dharma, I should not allow myself to be affected by these eight worldly concerns. However, we still will find that hopes, fears, and discursive thoughts of every description will come into our minds. The eight worldly concerns can creep up on us quite sneakily. Even when we do something virtuous, they try to slip in. So isn't that right? Even yes. When we're kind, somebody was bringing it, even when we're kind, it's like we're plagued by, what are people going to think of me? Or what was my true intention? Or whatever it is. It sneaks up on us. So in this story, it's example of how we're so affected by the outer conditions or what we think they might be, and then our inner conditions of self-judgment and everything come into play. So this is the benefit of having more equanimity, is that we're more peaceful inside. We're not necessarily going to have those inner judgments of ourselves or of others. So when the unpredictable outer conditions arise and the deeply set habit patterns coming from within constantly are kind of going out to meet those outer conditions, or maybe they're just thoughts and they're really not very good for our own mind stream, it's no wonder in life we feel closed down. It's no wonder in life we get overwhelmed and there's so much anxiety. We feel disconnected from our own hearts and discombobulated. You know, how in the world can we come from a place of wisdom in response to ourselves and to the world when we're allowing all of the outer world to trigger us and have the responses that are so deeply set patterns. So important questions to ask ourselves and to find our own answers, true, and listen to wisdom and see what we can take in, is how can we stay open and connected to the outer conditions of the world, as well as to the inner conditions of our hearts and minds, so that we have an abiding sense of inner calm and clarity. That's what it's all for. We want that for ourselves, for the family around us, for our community, so that we can sense clearly what's going on outwardly and inwardly, and we can act appropriately. So equanimity, I want to make a huge point of this, because sometimes people hear a talk on equanimity and that's all they hear. Oh, just being calm, centered, balanced, relaxed. And it's if that's all you get and you don't do anything. You know, you're just a blob in life, an equanimity blob. But it also means that we're clear. We're very clear about, we get a sense and we have a sense of, okay, what's going on out there? We can take that in with clarity. We can have a sense of our own hearts and minds, what's going on in here. We can act appropriately at the right time, in the right way. So that's what it's for. It's not for just being equanimous. It's for being able to act also, coming from a place of action or speech that's powerful, that's wholesome, that's beneficial, that's compassionate. That's a voice that comes from that place people will listen to. When a voice that's angry and upset, it might be loud, but you know, it's easy to close down to that too. So how can we have the appropriate and effective response is to develop more equanimity. So otherwise we're just reacting from unconscious habit patterns, just letting the habit patterns take over in our lives. And it takes a lot of strength and sometimes a long time to be able to really see the habit patterns, to have enough humility to open to them and to say not now or not ever, or just slow down and be able to hold back from something we're going to say or do that's going to cause harm, not only to others, but we have to think about our own karma, our own karmic stream. We're doing harm to ourselves, because what's happening is that action or that speech that we do to bring that thought pattern out is heavy karma. Just having it in our mind is karma enough. It's habitual karma. But when we act it out, it's heavy karma. It goes back into our mind stream to come up again with that kind of strength. So not doing it just for others, but for our own purification. So we need this quality to navigate the inner terrain of our hearts and to navigate the outer terrain of our lives. So equanimity implies balance, right? But it's not only that. The subjective experience is a spacious balance with an absence of reactivity. So it's a calm, spacious balance. That's what in the moment we might feel. And it's quiet inside. Calm, quiet, spacious, very wide balance. We're not kind of teeter-tottering on a razor's edge, afraid that, oh, if we just move this way, we're going to fall over, or that way, we're going to fall over. It's like we have a very wide base, like a mountain that has a wide base. So this is what the Buddha says about this equanimity. Develop a mind that is vast like space, where experiences, both pleasant and unpleasant, can appear and disappear without conflict or struggle or harm. Rest in a mind that is vast like space. So that implies equanimity. Sometimes an example of a rock, an unmoving rock, you know, a big rock, a boulder, or even like a mountain that's not affected by anything. You can't push this big boulder and make it move. It just stays steady in the heart, in the mind. But I love to find quotes by women too. So this quote by Izumi Shikibu, she was a poet in the 9th century Japan. I'm really fond of these poems. She says, "Watching the moon at midnight, solitary mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out." And that is a wonderful feeling, isn't it? When we're so quiet and maybe a wave of aversion comes by and it's like, okay, this is how it is right now. Just let it go by. Or a thunderbolt of anger comes and just let it happen really fast and not kind of be moved by it so much. Know the impermanent nature of it, the ephemeral part of understanding that. So this is an art to do this practice. It's kind of science when you know, there are causes and conditions that create this or that. But it's also an art to live in this world like this, knowing how things are and being quiet inside, spacious enough to accept how it all is. This is from Don Juan to Carlos Castañeda. "The art of being a spiritual warrior is to balance the terror of being human with the wonder of being human." And so that relates back to Izumi Shikibu, when knowing oneself completely, no part left out. So that's a kind of a wondrous thing, whatever is there, you make room for it. It's not, you don't go into this practice and say, "I only want to experience the illuminating parts of this practice." No, this is not the practice for you yet. Because when you open to the practice, you open to everything, not to just what's pleasant and what's illuminating. In the beginning I thought, oh, I just want to experience the light, you know, of enlightenment, when I didn't know much about this practice. And someone said to me, I can't remember who it was, somebody around me said, "Oh no, this isn't the practice for you, then you have to open to it all. And you can't go around it, you know, you have to go through it." Mm-hmm. So I was imagining when I work with some people who were very close to the anti-apartheid revolution in Africa, and who have told me what how much these the connection with knowing Nelson Mandela in their life was such a he was such a beautiful human being and a mentor, just not even knowing that person directly, of equanimity, because he was imprisoned for 27 years and he came out of that prison as a very strong person, you know, inner qualities, that was able to win the Nobel Peace Prize for his movement in the anti-apartheid revolution. And he was honored very much for the way he was in that way to Africa and to the world. So he must have had a lot of potential for equanimity when he was in prison, just actually honing that. So in this vast space, there can be a lot of wisdom when we're not crowded in by the near and far enemy of equanimity, which is the far enemy is two-pronged, two two parts of it is attachment and aversion. And the far enemy is just not caring. You know, it's just kind of standing aside and not caring about it, not doing anything about it. It may be calm, but because you're not, don't even want to be connected to what's happening. So when we see clearly, that means we're willing and courageous to be soberingly honest with ourselves about what's going on. Really taking a clear view of reality rather than, you know, just not wanting to look. I do some very simple phrases with equanimity. Somebody asked about that today. How can we practice equanimity? You can practice it like on the cushion. We're not doing that practice now, but you can find many talks, and actually I gave a few equanimity courses, retreats that are on Dharma Seed that you can listen to. Other people have too. But usually I use simple phrases like, it's like this right now. Say something difficult is happening around me, and I just, instead of, you know, feeling what's going on and just ready to act, I'm able to say, more often than not, or more often than in the past, I'm able to say, okay, this is what's going on right now. Let's take stock of this. This is what's going on right now around me. Or it's like this right now. And then when I look inside of me, I'm able to see and honestly say what's going on inside too. Because it's not enough to know what's going on clearly and have an absence of reactivity to the outside. It's important to face our inner experiences and be equanimous about that too, because oftentimes there's an immediate reaction, which is already equanimity. It's already reactivity. So what we need to do is place our practice of equanimity right here inside our own hearts. So more than the outside, I'm saying this is how it is inside me right now. And actually being honest with myself and saying, there's a lot of anger right now, or frustration, or I want it to be different. I don't want it to be like this. So it's seeing clearly what's going on. So I want you to, those of you taking notes, note down, there are three aspects to equanimity that are really, really important. Seeing clearly with a spacious, calm mind and heart. Balanced also. The second thing is caring deeply. Making that connection with what's happening out there, what's happening in your heart. And the third thing is acting wisely. So it includes all those things. Seeing clearly, caring deeply, acting wisely. So in this clear, vast space, the Buddha would say, for one who develops deep abiding equanimity, it is a natural law to know and see things as they really are, to know the Dhamma. So it's said that equanimity is the gateway to the unconditioned, because when we can really experience equanimity, nothing can really make the mind move towards anything unwholesome. Just the wholesome abilities of the mind come up. The ability to be aware, the ability to be wise, the ability, the potential to show compassion, and all the qualities that we need in this world. So I witness a strong and steady balance of this equanimity in a friend of mine, a yogi friend of mine, who said that the practice of equanimity helped her through very difficult times. So this is a very personal example of it. A few years ago, one of my friend's grown sons had just disappeared. Lived on Maui. We all lived on Maui. And I think that son was in his 20s. And he just disappeared from Maui. They looked all over for the son everywhere, asked the friends. Nobody was saying anything or did not know anything. And they were not able to discover what happened to him. They did everything they could. They couldn't find him. So not knowing what to do, she just kept an inner vigil. I mean, they were doing, even people were doing something in the background, investigators, everything, and they just released whatever funds needed to be released to help out. It was a great mystery and a great loss to her, and a lot of sorrow and pain, of course, you know, especially when we don't know where someone is or whether they're alive or not. This is a great mystery, sorrow, great hardship. She went on retreat, went on a retreat in Maui, where Steve and I often conducted retreats of a month long or 2 weeks. And she decided to do the equanimity practice. And her practice was about about her son, the loss of her son, and about her inner feeling about that loss. There's the traditional phrase of equanimity in, I'm going to give it to you. It's rather harsh sometimes. It's rather hard to take, but I'll share it with you. It's this: all beings are owners of their karma. Their happiness or unhappiness depends on their actions, not upon my wishes. So what she was trying to surrender to is like, this was the karma unfolding at this time. Very, very difficult for her. So during that time, I shared with her the phrase that I changed that into something else to make it easier for me to say for my own children. Because I had to practice a lot of equanimity with my own children. So my phrase was, all beings have their own journey. You know, when they just wanted to do the way they wanted to do, no matter whether you said, just I'm speaking metaphorically, if you said, please don't go down that river, I would say metaphorically, I know it's really bumpy down there and you're going to hit a waterfall and you're just going to go over that waterfall and something really tragic could happen to you. Please don't do that. But they would do it, right? So, but everybody's still safe, luckily. And that was my phrase. All beings have their own journey. I care for the bigger part of it, I care for your journey, but I can't control it. So it didn't leave out the care, but I had to keep telling myself, I can't control what happens in your life. So that's what my friend, that was her phrase, all beings have their own journey. So eventually she and her husband traveled to Europe, and they wanted to be with another daughter who was about to give birth to their first grandchild. So she wanted to be there, and it was a nice thing for them to do to get away. And just before they left, her son, who had disappeared, appeared. So, you know, there was loss and sorrow, and then there was gain and joy. So just with that same son and the same things happened like that. Gain and loss, joy and sorrow. So they went on their way, and when they were there in Europe to be with their daughter, they got their daughter gave birth to a beautiful child, you know, so that's beautiful, the joy of having a new grandchild. But while they were there, not long after that, they got news that their other son that they had left at home just tragically drowned. I mean, this all in a short period of time. And talk about, you know, vicissitudes of life. Boy, she really faced it. So she really experienced, you know, the joy of having a new child in the life and death of her other son. So we see this every day, and it's so indescribably painful, but when it happens to us, it's like the ultimate pain when we lose a child. So when we met later in Oregon, she said that she owed her steadiness and her steadfastness to the Dharma, because she did her practices. She did her metta, she did her equanimity, compassion, also, you know, her awareness practice. It really served her in her life. So she wrote this later and given me permission to say, quote her, "I feel most genuine when I can hold in my heart the sorrow of losing my son alongside the love and joy of who he was. I'm staying connected. It seems to me this kind of loss can either destroy us or make us stronger, and I'm determined to learn and grow from it. The Dharma has been very helpful." So, of course, you know, these have so many principles in it, expressed here with regard to equanimity. How she understood deeply that there's unknowable causes and conditions that happen in life. It didn't happen to her or son because she was being punished for something. It's just there's so many things that are involved in karma and in conditions that it said that if we tried to understand it, would make our head explode. So we really can't, it's not a linear one-to-one thing. So she understood that. And one thing about equanimity that she displayed here is she stayed connected. She stayed connected to her son. She stayed connected to her own heart, to the memory of her son, to her own heart. She didn't just kind of, you know, go away and try to close down and shut down. So one of the phrases that I use and that covers a lot of ground for me in relationship to my own family and people around me that are close, there's the unfolding of a person's life is a result of countless unknowable, untraceable causes and conditions which I cannot control. I almost have to remember that whole thing. There's countless causes and conditions which I cannot control, but I do have some influence as to how I respond to it. You know, how I remain with what goes on in my life. So I'm constantly learning these lessons. And you know, the Zen tradition says it very compactly. All of what I said, all I have to say is, in the Zen saying, my ancient twisted karma. You know, because it's so big and it's just going world cycles along with intersecting with other beings, etc. So this is how it is with our equanimity practice in life and things you can say to, even in daily life, you know, this is how it is right now. How can you just be with and rest with, this is how it goes right now in my life, you know, around me, and this is how it goes in my heart. We need to pay attention to both sides, not just to responding to life as best we can to the outer conditions, but don't forget the inner conditions. You need to respond to the inner conditions, to how it's going on in here. Can we bring equanimity to that? So I'll tell you a story about how I learned that I needed to do that more. And I did, you know, I have done it in this way. I have more of a practice of coming back here. But sometimes it backfires on us. So when we, when there's like a reactivity to what's going on outside, you can quietly notice, okay, this is what's going on outwardly. All right. So let's see what's going on inwardly. And if we're seeing what's going on in here, we're reactive, then we might choose not to say anything at that moment. So I was having this experience, a true experience, with one of my neighbors, and they're not my neighbors anymore, moved away. And we were having a dispute about boundaries, and where I was, Steve and I were mowing along the boundary line, and they didn't like us taking down all those, not just mowing, but cutting down all those tall, junky trees, you know. That gave them privacy. But we needed a place where we could walk around our boundary. And they say you really need that, you know, for fire control too, to be able to get up to places. So she came to my house, wanted to have a talk with me, but it turned out to be, you know, a lot of loud talking to one another. And so she was really upset, making her point. And I realized, okay, this is the way it is right now outside. So I really kind of felt a sense of, I'm surrendered to that, it's all right. And then I looked inside and said, this is the way it is in my heart. Oh boy, sometimes it's not all right. Sometimes I just want to say, you know, four-letter words. And so this happened. This is the way it is right now. I saw inside, I shouldn't say anything. So I said it out loud. I said to her, you know, I think I'm going to be quiet now because I'm looking inside and I'm a bit reactive and I shouldn't say anything right now. I'm a little confused. Let me get things together. And she said, that's right, Kamala. You're very confused. Something like that. Wow. I really had to stay with my inner. So even now, you know, just to think of it, it's like I just wanted to go, boom. I don't do that, by the way, but it feels like it sometimes. You know, just remembering His Holiness the Dalai Lama says this, when you do something like that and you don't do or say something because you know it's not going to be good, that's called the inner disarmament. That's better than disarming all the atomic bombs. If many of us could do that, that would be really good. So, yeah, there are many metaphors used to describe this type of equanimity. Infinite spaciousness, you know, those steady rocks. Ajahn Sumedho, one of our great Thai monks, said, the mind can be like space. There is room in it for everything or nothing. Armies can come and go into the mind and leave. Butterflies, rain clouds, or nothing. All things can come and go through without us, without being caught within us, without being caught in reaction or resistance. So seeing if we can have a mind like that is really important in our home life, in our deep, in our deepening understanding of life. So just to come to an end now, I want to talk about the direct opposites of equanimity, called the far enemy and the near enemy. It's called the far enemy because you can see it from afar. It's pretty noticeable. And as I've been saying, it comes in two parts. It's the many ways that aversion shows up or attachment shows up in our minds. So it takes a lot of strength and courage to face that, and a lot of humility to face what's going on inside. Someone said, the author is still not known, the spiritual path is one humiliation after another when we really face what's going on inside. So that's the far enemy. And the near enemy is called the near enemy because it can feel like that. Sometimes it's like an emotional emptiness. It's manifested as apathy, indifference, passivity, complacency. You know, when you just kind of, it feels calm, but it's more like you don't care and you're not connecting. Someone named it an emotional emptiness, and I think that's very, very adept. So it said that equanimity succeeds when there is clarity to see things as they really are with an evenness of mind. And it fails when it falls into indifference, disconnection, and a distant callousness. I just want to end with a sense of equanimity I had one time when I was visiting with Manindraji in India. I went to visit him because I didn't know how much longer he would be alive. So it wasn't the last time I went. But during this time, he thought it might, he was elderly in his 80s already, 85 or more, and he wanted to take me to Varanasi. He wanted us to visit Varanasi. And it's one of the oldest, if not the oldest, cities in the world. And he wanted to go there because that's where the burning ghats are, you know, and they, and one of the things about in the Buddhist tradition is to really be able to face death, you know, and to see it and be close to it. And so he said, as only a Buddhist teacher would say to you, at least this Buddhist teacher, he wanted me to go down the river, the Ganges River, where you would see the burning ghats, because we might see some bodies floating on the river. And I would think, what? You know? But of course, you know, to be able to see how it is, you know, with the body at the time of death. So we took a boat down the Ganges River, and it was very early morning. And on the boat, I was really happy to be with my friends, because a few friends went with me, and Manindra there. As we were going down, the burning ghats were on the right side, and on the far left, on the horizon, was the sun coming up. Mm-hmm. And because we had to get the boat at dark, you know, before dawn, so we could see the sun rising. And there, so a birth of a new day, you know, on this side. And then just looking at the other side, there's death. So it was like right at that moment I was thinking, wow, just in the birth of a new day, and here are people here just being with death, somebody dying. And then after that, there were families in sadness and grief, you know, seeing those on the right of me. But here beside me was a teacher, one of my teachers, the first teacher I've had. And it's nice, you know, I was so happy to be sitting beside him and my dear friends also. So there's sadness on one side, happiness on another side. And then being in India itself is... India is so, its beauty is in its rawness too. So being with the rawness of life, being with the beauty of life, I mean, just all these opposites I was realizing. The banks of the poor, on the banks of the river, there's a poor and the destitute, but also just feeling very rich in my own life with the Dharma. So it's all these opposites. And the mind that's able, the heart that's able to hold it, it can really open your heart in that kind of emptiness, in that kind of spaciousness, with the equanimity. So, keeping this sense of equanimity in our practice and learning how to make use of it in our lives as we, you know, tomorrow being our last day, I hope you're still going to keep your silence and keep your practice tomorrow. But even as we go ahead into life, we have fears and dreads and happinesses that we want to hold on to, and getting out in the world and doing what we need to do. Equanimity is said to be the most powerful of the four Brahma-viharas, those four divine emotions of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and then there's equanimity. Said that equanimity empowers all the others to be stronger. And having equanimity also is called the doorway to the unconditioned, the doorway to Nibbana. So even in our Vipassana practice, it's held very, very highly. So what one experiences right before great openings or, you know, the unconditioned, it's said to be equanimity. So very important that we develop this in our lives and not forget it. You know, keep it with us. Developing a mind that's clear, that's balanced, that's spacious, that can hold everything so that it can see everything clearly, not avoid, not push back or turn away when it gets hard. So I'd just like to end with, I picked up this book called The Way It Is by William Stafford, and there's a poem in there about equanimity, and the poem is called The Way It Is. There's a thread you follow, it goes among things that change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. Don't ever lose the thread. You know, that thread of equanimity. So let's sit for a few moments and let those words dissolve. Thank you for your kind attention.